I'm prepared to do anything I can to play it comfortably again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
A really good and busy football show for you on the way. We will talk to David Winner, who author of Brilliant Orange, the neurotic genius of Dutch football, about their latest neurotic move. It is Ronald Koeman, who will take over from Dick Advocaat as Netherlands manager. Advocaat obviously resigned after failing to guide the Dutch to the 2018 World Cup. And so Koeman is in, and he's in. He'll take them to Euro 2020, and his contract takes him up to 2022. So we'll see what the reaction in Holland is to that appointment and just where Dutch football is. Arjen Robben retiring effectively at the moment, and basically the end of any of their players at top European clubs in the last number of years. And then the Munich air disaster is 60 years ago today. So Wayne Barton will join us, author of Jimmy Murphy, the man who kept the red flag flying, which is released this week, about Jimmy Murphy, who played a huge role in rebuilding Manchester United. He was assistant coach, he was chief scout. Interestingly, he was offered the Brazil job and declined it. He didn't like the attention. He was Welsh, didn't like attention, liked being the number two. And we'll hear more about him. Obviously, Liam Whelan in people's thoughts around Dublin today.
Yeah, there was a. I saw there was a minute's applause at the Liam Whelan Bridge in Cabra today. I saw some pictures. You know, I think people go to his grave today too. And there was an event in Home Farm tonight as well. Mm. So, you know, probably the greatest Irish footballer that we've had that so little has been seen of, in terms of, you know, there's not a huge amount or very little sort of video footage or stuff out there. You're relying on the stories of people that watched him play. Mm. And, you know, unfortunately, there's not necessarily a huge amount of them sort of left, you know, in terms of the vivid recollection. I did a piece last September just on the fact that European Cup campaign for Manchester United started in Dublin at Dalyman Park against Shamrock Rovers. And
58 one.
And it was actually 57, because it was obviously the 57-58 season. So like a historic match when the Busby Babes came to Dalyman. And I spoke to a couple of the Rovers lads, Eamon Darcy, the goalkeeper, Tommy Hamilton, who was very good friends. He was ex-Manchester United and like best friends with Whelan. And it was just great to chat to those guys. They'd all lived in Manchester in the 50s, and they were able to just give you a more vivid picture of who Liam Whelan was and what type of fella he was. And, you know, he was very homesick, didn't necessarily ever settle with being away, but he was an exceptional talent. He was 22. And I mean, the same stories apply to any of the Busby Babes, but this was the Irish one.
Yeah.
You know, this was the player that could have been, you know, we could have qualified for tournaments. You think of the playoff in 65 for 66, you know, Liam Whelan could have been in his prime. There's a lot of stories he can tell, and you know, you can't just all distill it in football terms. It's a human element. I think he was engaged to be married at the time and stuff like that. It's something that I got to speak to Liam's brother Christy as well, and still, you know, he's still carrying the message and telling the stories of going to watch him in, you know, in his pomp, I guess. And I mean, it's 60 years, and I think it's good that Manchester United have honoured it well, because, you know, you read up that in the early years after Munich, they didn't necessarily do a great job when it came to that, and when it came to some of the survivors and stuff like that. So it appears they've righted the wrong eventually.
Well, Philip Quinn was in doing the Sunday paper review a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned a book, the name of which escapes me now. It was a book Manchester United didn't want written.
Mm.
One of the issues, it seems, was that a number of the players lived in houses provided by the club.
Yes.
And their families would have been in those houses as well. And so in the few weeks after the disaster, there were widows answering the door to Manchester United club representatives telling them that, well, look, I'm very sorry and all, but you and your children can't stay here anymore. Out you go.
Yes. And there was a couple of players who suffered injuries that, you know, basically stopped them from being able to play. I think Blanche Flower was one, and Northern Irish player. And, you know, I think there was just services that the club offered that were withdrawn, you know. So a bit of a sorry episode. But I guess I think over time the families feel, I think they were welcomed back in, although, I mean, it was in some cases, yeah, there's sad stories there, but I feel eventually they've got it right, you know. And I think the sort of the legacy of the Babes lives on, I suppose, through the stories that people tell today, and you know, we'll continue to tell sort of long after the survivors have passed, I guess, you know.
An Irish striker who did have the chance to fulfill his potential and have a long career is Robbie Keane, who is out in the Indian Super League
guest
at the moment. And you've been looking at this story. It seems his career may take another interesting twist.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Indian media are reporting that he has a chance of becoming the manager of ATK, it's Atletico de Calcutta. Teddy Sheringham was his manager, got the bullet last month,
right.
And Ashley Westwood has taken over, name people might remember from sort of playing football in the English leagues, but apparently he doesn't fulfil the criteria for being a marquee boss. He's only not a big enough name for this new gig, so he can only manage for 3 games.
Okay.
And they need someone for the last 5 games of the season. Well, Robbie's at the club already.
Right.
Robbie wants to be a manager one day.
He is famous.
He's definitely marquee. And what he fancy? I don't know. I can't imagine things have gone as he would have planned. They're 8th in the table.
Right.
They're not doing especially well. Sheringham's gone. But Robbie Keane has always been clear about his intentions to go into management one day. This would only be a short. This is like someone, you know, give it to Giggsy till the end of the season thing. But still, it would be interesting if you got a go at it.
Well, there are only 5 matches left and he hasn't had a particularly brilliant time out there. He's had a few injuries, Keane. He's 37 years old now. He's made just 6 appearances and he scored 2 goals. But that's since November. So it hasn't quite been the LA Galaxy experience.
No. And I think, it's a very short and unusual season that they have there. An injury ruled them out of what turned out to be a significant portion of it.
Yeah.
I think Robbie is someone that's not going to disappear from our, you know, the Irish football scene, from the discussion. I'm convinced Robbie Keane will manage Ireland one day. I think it's something that will happen.
Right.
So we're going to find out soon, I guess, about his managerial style. He has to get on the ladder somewhere.
Dan, nobody goes on the radio of an evening intending to talk about poo, but right. I feel I must.
Okay.
Because a few weeks ago, we talked at length about a poor Sunderland fan who had a few too many sherries.
Oh, yes, yes.
Turned up at the stadium alight, proceeded to pull down his trousers, take his seat calmly back on his seat.
Oh, yeah. It was an unfortunate
story.
And
go to the toilet whilst watching the match.
Yes.
And people text in saying, typical football fans.
Hmm.
Rugby, Dan, has its own issues.
Oh, yeah. Go.
The Wales Online report today caught the eye.
Right.
This was in Cardiff. This was after Wales had that stunning victory over Scotland at the weekend.
Okay.
So we're not condemning all football fans. The owner of the Dog and Piano pub.
This was in Cardiff, right? Cardiff, yeah.
The Dog and Piano in Cardiff, Nicola Morris, recounting an unfortunate incident at the weekend, Dan. There were a group of around 12 to 15 men who came in after the rugby.
Right.
I was walking around the pub when a member of staff came over and alerted me to what had happened. Someone had defecated on the table at the front of the pub. Another one of the group had then got an empty pint glass and stuck it in the mess.
Oh.
Upsetting for Nicola. She said, nothing like this has ever happened before.
I mean, in Cardiff, I'd say it possibly has. Have you ever been in Cardiff on a Saturday night show?
No.
I mean, it is anything goes territory. I mean, that can't be the most shocking thing they've encountered in the Dog and Piano.
Nothing like this has ever happened before in the Dog and Piano, said Nicola. Working in a pub, you have to clean things up in the toilet from time to time, but not this. My dog is better behaved, she said of the group. Some left straight away, but even the ones that did must have stood by while he was doing it. I didn't know it at the time, but the last one to leave the pub was the person who did it. He even gave me a hug before he left.
Yeah.
What happened is beyond belief, and it sickens us to the pit of our stomachs. There you go. That was rugby types, Dan.
You know, you just can't. I mean, they're supposed to be gentlemen.
That makes the Stadium Alight incident look positively.
Oh, I mean, he was just trying to watch the game. He just didn't want to leave his seat because he was such a committed fan.
Oh, dear.
He hadn't been to bed, you know.
It was
a sorry tale. But yeah, there you go. Again, though, Cardiff, I mean, it's...
Is that right?
It's a hell of a place on a Saturday evening. They come in from the valleys. It's definitely... I mean, maybe a lot of Ireland fans might have been there for the game in October, but Saturday night in Cardiff, they take away all that sort of outdoor furniture at a certain time.
Okay.
You know, that's all removed. You go anywhere where there's seats outside, there comes a point where the seats are no more.
Right.
Standing room only, because that's probably better for the long run. And they do have a place called Chippy Valley because it's just all the chippers in one area, which is...
That's a recipe for disaster, isn't
it? Not a great part of town. But, I mean, I know people who love it.
Right. I've never been.
Never been to Cardiff? Yeah.
Mm.
There's other places you can go, I think. Okay. Yeah. Ireland are back there later this year. I don't think people were like, great, Cardiff, you know?
So today in your work, you were at this Bohemian's St. Kevin's launch. Yeah, people have been vaguely aware of the situation whereby for generations in this country, the DDSL clubs, schoolboy clubs, we know all the names, supplied the bulk of future Irish internationals and future Irish professionals generally. And so it's worked to a point, and the schoolboy clubs have done a great job until players reached 14, 15 and went over to the UK and were further developed there. And Rude Doctor and the FAI have looked at this situation and felt that we need national leagues.
Yeah.
And the under-19s league is in place and the under-17s league is in place, and they've come in. And the logic is very clear that you get a higher standard of football. And the under-15s league, national league, has proved to be more contentious because these great schoolboy clubs, especially around Dublin, have felt, well, you know, why? Where does that leave us? What becomes of the DDSL, the biggest league in Europe, schoolboy league in Europe?
And they weren't, and they sought to apply to participate in this tournament or the under-15 league, and were refused. Okay. Basically, told that this is for League of Ireland clubs only, and if you want to be in it, you need to partner with a League of Ireland club.
And the justifiable complaint of schoolboy clubs, I think, was that League of Ireland clubs have shown little or no interest in developing proper academy systems or developing footballers. They have left it to the schoolboy, the St. Kevin's, the Stella Maris, the Belvedere's, the Home Farms of Dublin to develop young players. Yeah. And so suddenly, why are we handing over our potentially our best players to League of Ireland clubs with no track record here? So where are we now on the under-15 situation? Because as I understand it, it kicks off in March. And I know you were covering Bohemians have linked up with St. Kevin's today. And that was officially, well, they've linked up with them before, but it was officially launched
today.
So where have all the schoolboy teams around the DDSL come to accept this? Like, is everything rosy in the garden now, or what's going on?
I don't think you could describe it as rosy. I think Kevin's were the highest profile angry one, I guess, because they've had the recent success with Brady and Hendrick, and they've been very efficient and high quality in recent years in terms of player production. Kevin's were so put out by not being allowed into the under-15 league that they thought about, they contemplated applying to join the League of Ireland First Division, just so they would be able to keep their underage players. Because, I mean, the underage players, they do have a value to these clubs in terms of compensation if they go to England. That's how they finance the operations that they run. But they also run high-class stuff from the age of six upwards. So the FAI wanted Kevin's to go into partnership with clubs. They were rejecting it. Then they were allowed to... They were the only team that was allowed to enter a schoolboy side. They were only schoolboy operation that was allowed into the first under-15 league, which was a truncated half-season that was played from like last summer through to the end of the season. Kevin's were allowed in it. All the other schoolboy clubs that have since partnered with League of Ireland clubs kicked up over that and said, well, hang on.
Yeah.
We went in with these guys, and now you've let them in.
Yeah.
But long story short, Kevin's and Bowes, two Northside clubs, down the road from each other, bit of shared history in terms of players and staff and so on. They have sorted it out, and they now are, they are Bowes and Kevin's at under 13 level, which is coming in, and under 15. At 17, 19, they're Bowes, but they're using Kevin's facilities. I guess they've worked out something behind the scenes, an arrangement that in terms of if an outstanding 15, 16 year old comes through and goes away, you'd imagine, you know, the Kevins are not going to be losing out as they feared they might have. But this is common sense, really, that, you know, we have too many clubs in Dublin in senior football, arguably, but then even the nurseries, and they all have their own great history. But there is just a logic in sharing resources and sharing facilities and, you know, sharing expertise and knowledge. And I think from the Kevin's point of view today, speaking to the people involved, that it was actually, negotiations were a bit sticky, but it was when the Bowes first team staff got involved, the people got around the table and realised this could be good for both football
for
clubs.
And so how does it work? Because I'm seeing here there's an agreement now that the clubs will enter a joint team when the under-15 season kicks off in March. So a schoolboy football, that is still August to May territory?
No, it's going to be summer now. The national leagues are going to be summer, yeah.
No, I know the national leagues are.
Yeah, but no, there is a, yeah, there is issue.
Is DDSL still the traditional August to May?
Yeah, and there's been a move towards changing towards summer football generally. And the one point about this is, and this is you'd speak to people involved in DDSL clubs. They would argue now that the League of Ireland clubs are coming in and just taking the best players from the DDSL.
I was going to ask, so a joint team. So are St. Kevin's matches happening on a weekend and Bohemian's matches are happening on a weekend and the best schoolboy players have to choose to play in one of them, or the season's not happening at the same time?
Oh, no, no. The Kevins, under anyone at Kevins under 30 and upwards is now with Kevins Bows. They're not also playing separately for Kevins elsewhere. Like, this is...
Is there a St. Kevin's in the DDSL anymore?
Up to under 12, and I assume there's still going to be teams below that, but, you know, it's... But the Kevins are now part of the underage national leagues.
So they are no longer... DDSL no longer has a St. Kevin's.
Well, it does up the age grade.
I'm
not sure what's going to happen when the 13s comes in. Actually,
sure. But from 15s on, there's no St. Kevin's DDSL.
No, but the problem that they've had, and speak to people involved, but you know, the dropout level when you get to a certain age, the upper age groups now, they knew they were going to be wiped out when the under 15 National League came in, mm-hmm. because obviously better players are going away. Yeah. And the argument would be with regard to what happens to the players that left behind. There's a fear that there's going to be a huge dropout rate. In terms of,
I was going to say, who plays in the DDSL under 15, under 16?
That's the challenge. Yeah, that's
will
an area.
Be a St. Kevin's team?
There are teams. I mean, well, as much as there's partnerships, but you still have, you know, you still have Belvo, and you still have the other schoolboy teams that are left behind. And this is, you know, this is the difficult aspect of it. But the flip side is that, you know, from speaking to people certainly involved with Kevin's today who would have been critical of the leagues before, they are now actually saying they were very happy with the standard of the under 15 National League that they briefly participated in, okay. and they will be in the future. That, you know, you go around the country now to Limerick or Waterford and you're now playing the best players from the region rather than, you know, teams with two or three.
So it may just be that going forward, there is the National League where you have your Kevin's Bows team and other League of Ireland teams playing against each other, and Dublin sides against Limerick sides, and the very best players in the country are all in that league. And then the DDSL, with respect to, God, jeez, I mean, who are we to talk about? With respect to the teams left in the DDSL and the players in that league, the DDSL will be a lower standard than it may have been in previous generations.
Yeah, that certainly is going to happen. But this is part of the argument about getting the elite players around the country together early. And
right. It's a tough one. There is a fair logic there, and it's tough to, you don't want to reduce the DDSL and say, oh, it's now the players who haven't been picked for the National League, but that is what it is.
Yeah, now it is true. Now, sometimes the problem they've had, you know, at under 16 level DDSL is that maybe outstanding players have all gone to England at 15, so there's always been an element of the team being left behind.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know, that has always existed. That's always been there. And I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, how it's going to operate in terms of the DDSL upper end. They've always had those problems, I think, but they're losing more to clubs now. To the higher end League of Ireland clubs, they're losing a lot of players. And
okay.
It's certainly that is the other side of it, participation wise.
Well, the 2018 SSC Electricity Under 15s League kicks off in March, so we'll see how it all transpires. Meanwhile, David Winner, who we mentioned was coming on the show, author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football, is on the line. Evening, David.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks for joining us. So, Ronald Koeman, who has been out of work since losing his job at Everton in October, has work again. He has signed a 4.5 year contract as Netherlands manager, which will include the 2022 World Cup. He replaces Dick Advocaat, who resigned after they failed to make the 2018 World Cup. What's been the general reaction to the Koeman appointment?
Fairly positive. He's widely seen as the best guy for the job. Frank de Boer was somewhat in the running, but Koeman was always thought to be in sort of pole position, partly because he had a good relationship with the head of the Dutch Federation, a guy called Erik Hudde, who he'd worked under at Feyenoord a few years ago. So he's, you know, hugely experienced. He's worked in Spain and Portugal and England and in Holland. He's, you know, one of the legendary former players. It was one that was part of the team that won the Euro 88. Fairly popular appointment.
Mm. So what kind of squad is he inheriting at this stage? Iron Robin retired last year. It seems like Schneider and Van Persie and that caliber of player, they're all out the door as
they're
well.
They're all gone.
Yeah, they're all gone. So what is Koeman picking up the pieces with not very much, or is there a sense of optimism about the calibre of player?
A few months ago, when they failed to qualify for the World Cup, there was general sturm and drang. You know, it was thought to be the end of Dutch football as we know it, because they've had this problem of not enough good young players coming through, and there was a sort of gap between the old guys that you just listed, who'd done terrifically well in the 2010 and 2014 World Cups, and then the sort of next generation, and there was this sort of yawning gap. And the other problem is that Holland has fallen behind the rest of, you know, the real trailblazers. They're used to, for most of the last 40, 50 years, they were used to being in the vanguard, and now they clearly are not, in large part because they all their advantages and all their sort of insights and training methods and philosophy were adopted by others, a bit like Britain invented railways before everybody else, but no longer has the best railway system because it was copied and so on. So that was the mood a few months ago. Slightly more optimistic at the moment, because a lot of the young guys from the 2014 World Cup are sort of maturing quite nicely. So, for example, Stefan de Vrij, who would have been 21, 22 at that time, and he was considered, you know, not one of the great stars of that team, but he's emerged as a really, really rather formidable defender in Italy, playing at Lazio. Kevin Strootman, who was injured for a long period, and he was the sort of hard but effective and could play a bit too kind of midfielder. He's come through his injury problems and is now playing very well at Roma. Daley Blind is still he's matured into he's not a world beater, but he's a very, very solid guy to have in your team. And you've got guys like Memphis Depay, who's thriving after his period in Manchester. Wijnaldum's doing okay at Liverpool. Matthijs de Ligt, who had a terrible debut as a 17-year-old last year. I forget who it was against. It was one of the crucial World Cup qualifiers, and he made a mistake which led to Holland. I think it was Bulgaria, was it? I can't remember. Holland losing an important game, but he was expected to kind of struggle in the absence of Davinson Sanchez after Sanchez left out Ajax and went to Spurs. But De Ligt has really come through, and he's shown, as they say, great mental strength. He's a real prospect now. The one thing they don't really have is a great striker. But it's looking sort of not too bad. Certainly looking like a team that should be able to qualify for the next Euros, having failed to qualify for the 2016 Euros and this year's World Cup. So not quite as bad as we thought it was. In fact, almost encouraging.
David, how has the Koeman appointment been received? I mean, how is he perceived in Holland? How is he remembered? Obviously, we know he was a fantastic player, but in terms of his reputation and the type of character they think he's going to bring to the side?
Well, he's widely respected. He's considered a bit strict, a bit of a disciplinarian, which might not suit sort of sensitive players. I don't know, Wijnaldum, for example, he needs encouragement, one of those players who needs encouragement rather than being sort of shouted at and treated a bit severely. Memphis Depay also is quite sensitive, takes subtle handling. There is a sort of slightly darker side to Koeman, which is not widely known even or talked about, which is, for example, his relationship with Louis van Gaal is terrible because of an incident that happened when van Gaal, in the early 2000s, when Koeman was coach at Ajax and van Gaal was the director of football, there was a problem in the dressing room that Rafael van der Vaart and Zlatan Ibrahimovic basically were fighting the whole time. They just couldn't stand each other. And Van Gaal, as director of football, came to Koeman and said, look, you've got to get rid of one of them. I don't really care who it is because this kind of situation can't go along. You know, your call, your choice. And Koeman got rid of Ibrahimovic. And a short time later, after Ajax lost, I think it was to Bayern Munich, lost quite heavily, 3-0 or something. And his excuse after the game was that Van Gaal had told me to sell Ibrahimovic. Hmm. Now, this is not a kind of incident that reflects terribly well on Koeman, but it's not that kind of thing isn't generally known. Hmm. So until he sort of drops a clangor or two in the national team, his reputation is fairly good still. As to his failure, for example, at Everton, people see that more as, you know, well, he had to sell Lukaku, and that was the end of that team. He was very dependent. That team was dependent on Lukaku for its goals. So yeah, he comes with everybody expecting, you know, solid, capable, sort of decent in the Dutch tradition kind of approach.
Yeah, I mean, you're better placed than most to talk about the Dutch tradition and you know, post Cruyff and Michaels, Michels. This is it's been just such a fascinating a melting pot to watch. Yeah. and the footballing philosophy to watch, and increasingly seems haunted by its past, and the weight of history is a heavy
absolutely.
One. I was reading Marcel Brands of PSV back in 2014 when he was there, and he was a technical director at PSV, and he was talking with Mark Overmars at Ajax and Martin van Giel at Feyenoord, so the three technical directors almost meeting, chatting about where Dutch football should go. And Brands said, we develop many intelligent, tactically strong players. We just need to improve the winning factor. He says, I went to Portugal recently to Sporting and Benfica and Porto. It's completely different there. There it's all about winning. With us here, the Dutch, it's the exact opposite. 80% possession, played well, yes, but we lose 1-0. So that was the general feeling in the past number of years. And there's also been a sense, I think Bergkamp has alluded to it, talking about the academy players not almost being able to think for themselves or lacking the ingenuity of a Luis Suarez, who arrived at Ajax and had those street fighter instincts. He would find a way in any given situation as opposed to looking for guidance. And, you know, like, so all of these things are swirling around, and all the while you can almost feel the ghost of Cruyff looking down disapprovingly.
Well, there's also this whole relationship with their past is fascinating, because one of the things that stands out obviously with the generation of Cruyff and Michels that broke through in the 60s and in the 70s, the Dutch became and then remained that way for about 30 years, is sort of the vanguard of world football.
Yeah.
They might not win the World Cup, but they, you know, everybody looks to them for tactically, and the technical level was so remarkable. And they had this, for a tiny country, extraordinary sort of production line talent. So you think, but all of that was radical and new, and it looked to the future and not to the past. And there's a slight parallel you could possibly draw with, you know, Liverpool looking back to Bill Shankly and revering him, and, you know, setting that a little bit in, well, you know, the rosy memories, and you want to sort of pay tribute and revere all of that tradition. And yet when Shankly arrived, he was absolutely an innovator, and he didn't, you know, look backwards, he looked forwards. So the irony is that in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, the Dutch have become very nostalgic and very backward-looking and very conservative, in that they're sort of looking back to their radical period as set in stone, we have always to play like this. And Cruyff was part of that, because he, for example, he was very resistant when he was still alive. There were big, almost theological arguments about tactical formations, and they were always quite loose, but he was a passionate believer and advocate of 4-3-3. So that is the way you play. That is the way you train your youngsters. That is the solution to football. And of course, there's lots of flexibility in the world game now. So people have taken on all the Dutch insights, but then they've done interesting things with them. So the Germans are very innovative. The Spanish version, the Barcelona Spanish version of the Dutch game, which was brought in by Cruyff and then took on some Spanish characteristics. Guardiola's, you know, now back in the vanguard, but it's not exactly the Dutch style. It's sort of rooted in it, but it's got new elements. So Klopp at Liverpool also has new elements. And there are a few people in Holland who say, well, look, we should really have looked outside the country and try to give, you know, an injection of international, not just international flavour, but sort of keeping up with and adapting to changes in world football. And we should have gone for either a respected international coach or one of those sort of young Turks if they'd taken it. So this whole question of what you do with this fantastic legacy, is a live one, because in some ways they are rooted in the past in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, and David, can I ask, is there a thought leader in Dutch football at the moment? Is there a de facto Cruyff figure, or is everyone kind of scrambling?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not. I mean, the Koeman, to a degree, sort of 10, 15 years ago almost, was a slightly fresh figure in that he would, even though he'd worked with, you know, worked with Cruyff for many years, and he was steeped, and he played in the team managed by Rinus Michels in '88 and so on. But he'd played at PSV, and he was quite pragmatic as a coach. And you had sort of rather defensive Ajax teams on occasion, and this was considered a bit heretical back then. He's not a devout Cruyffian in the way that Cruyff would probably demand if he was still around. Mm-hmm. Much more flexible in that way, but not really. I mean, you didn't see it at Everton. You didn't see it at Southampton. You didn't see him as a great tactical innovator.
No, or particularly exciting.
No, exactly. He was very competent. He was very solid, but nothing sparky going on.
Yeah.
And there are no such coaches in Holland at the moment.
Okay.
And the old generation, you know, the great generation of coaches, people like Hiddink, Advocaat was never considered a great coach, but he was a very, very good one. They're sort of finished now. Van Gaal also, you know, who was an absolutely a great coach, but he's basically out of the game now. So, yeah, no, they are a bit isolated, a bit backward-looking, a little bit stuck.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All very interesting. We'll see what effect Koeman has on things. David Winner, a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time. Oh,
Actually, wait, yes. I've already left. I've gone.
Ooh, no, you're back. There was one thing. It just so happened, Wayne Rooney did Monday Night Football last night in Sky Sports.
Yes.
And a lot of people were quite impressed with Rooney and the insight he had given. And I saw a few people saying, well, we shouldn't really be that surprised that someone who was one of the best players in the world for a number of years actually has something to say about the game. And a few people tweeted an interview you did with him, actually, a number of years ago. Alan Shearer had interviewed him around the same time. And you made the point that, I mean, you didn't dress him up as, a perfect, unbelievable mind. And you know, kind of, I think you said he used the word obviously a lot, and, you know, as quirks. But,
well, he's not verbally terribly skilled, but
you found him
a phenomenal brain.
Talk to us about the phenomenal brain then.
Well, I when was this? It would have been about 2011?
11, 12, 12, yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
I did an interview with him in very trying circumstances, actually, because I didn't get a proper sit down with him. I had to sort of stand up and talk to him first. I only had like 20, 25 minutes with him. It was ridiculous. He was doing a photo shoot, and his agent, Paul Stretford, was sort of butting in all the time. And, oh, you can't ask that. So it wasn't terribly propitious circumstances, right. But I thought, well, I'll ask him about stuff nobody ever asks him, namely how he plays. Because one thing that always struck me about his game was how brilliant his movement was. And, you know, you'd see him working not just angles, but spaces. And I thought, well, that's very different. He's not Alan Shearer, smashing player, though he was in a different way. He's really a clever player, except he's always painted as a moron. Moron would be, he was absolutely mocked for being supposedly stupid.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll ask him, about his game. And the answers that he gave were fascinating because he was deeply thoughtful.
Mm.
And he said, for example, that the movement thing, he was always said to have been a fan, admirer of Duncan Ferguson.
Mm.
Well, yes, but the guy he studied was Jari Litmanen, the Finn who played for Ajax. He said he used to get videos of him and watch his movement.
Mm.
How's he doing that? He said there was a whole thing about he visualized before, self-taught. There was no psychologist came in and told him what is now orthodoxy. You try and imagine before a game, situations that might arise and then think your way through it. And he would ask the kit man, for example, what colors are we wearing tomorrow? What color socks? He said a wonderful thing, that he was always much more tired mentally when he came off the pitch than physically, because he was always trying to think 2 or 3 seconds ahead, 2 or 3 moves ahead. Mm. Some people would say like a chess game, but he said like in snooker, because that was his reference point.
Mm.
And I came away, I liked him a lot. I thought he was a really, decent guy. And very, very thoughtful, very clever. And I wrote it up like that.
Yeah. People can search out the internet.
And now people are seeing it.
yeah, it's funny. It was doing the rounds on Twitter today. So search David Winner, Wayne Rooney, and you'll come across the interview. It was on ESPN. It's worth a read for people interested in Rooney. David, now I will let you go. Thanks a million.
Okay.
All right, David Winner there. Thank you, author of Brilliant Orange, the neurotic genius of Dutch football. It must be a tough thing in Dutch football to have the Cruyff Mikkels
hanging
over, and this is how we play the game here, and this is how we do it in the future forever.
And 2 qualifications missed out back to back as well, and what must take. Ironically enough, in the context of our earlier discussion, we have of course gone the Dutch route in terms of our underage football. The Dutch template sounded like the way to go. We had Wim Kuvermans, and now we have Ruud Dokter, and you think the Dutch way is the right way to go. And now questions are being asked about the Dutch way.
Yeah,
so it's funny the way it's panned out.
DDSLer Summer since last year. Do your homework, says a very nice person. The rest of the country switching to summer in 2020. Yeah, Dan did make the point.
It's on the way. Yeah.
I asked, apologies for asking a question I didn't know the answer to. I didn't know we were going to be talking about it beforehand. It's a 3-hour show. You can't predict everything. Although, Dan, you are in trouble. Are you for real? Cardiff is a great city to visit. The Cardiff Mafia are out, and
Cardiff tourist board.
There's going to be a horse head in your bed, let me tell you.
That'd be standard fare in Cardiff, I'd say.
There's plenty of Cardiff people texting in, not happy with you. Your comments are typical for a soccer head, says somebody.
That's a fair shout.
It is, yeah. They were tough comments. 53106 is the text number. So the Munich air disaster 60 years ago today. We're going to talk with Wayne Barton, who's written a book soon to be published on one of the characters that isn't really talked too much about when it comes to Munich and how Manchester United went from decimation in 58 to European champions in 68. And that's Jimmy Murphy, who Matt Busby told to keep the club afloat while everybody recovered. So we're going to hear a bit more about Jimmy Murphy next.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
On the fringe of a Munich airport lies the wreckage of an airliner, still smouldering from a crash in which 21 people were killed. Tragedy enough at any time. But in that plane were a group of young men who were almost the personal friends of millions. Manchester United, the finest soccer team Britain has produced since the war. And 7 of them died in the crash.
Pathé news there on the Munich disaster, air disaster, February 6, 1958. There's so many strands to this story. I'm sure most of you listening are familiar with a lot of them. So we wanted to pick up on one that we haven't really talked too much on the show before, and there's a new book out about Jimmy Murphy, The book is called Jimmy Murphy, The Man Who Kept the Red Flag Flying. It's released on February 15th and you can order it at sportmediashop.com. We have the author Wayne Barton standing by live on the line. Evening, Wayne.
Evening, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well. So, Jimmy Murphy is not somebody we've talked about overly on the show before. Just to give a flavour of the man himself, he was, I mean, the assistant and a scout at Manchester United. We have a clip of him here. And this is Jimmy Murphy recalling how he first heard about the Munich air disaster, because he was on he was managing the Welsh team at that time as well, which meant he wasn't on that particular trip to Munich. So this is Jimmy Murphy recalling how he first heard about the Munich air disaster, and it was on Granada Television, a documentary called Munich Remembered. And this was marking the 30th anniversary. So Jimmy Murphy here speaking in 1988.
A taxi from town and got the office at the top end there, and Alma George, who was our secretary then, I went upstairs, and there seemed to be no one. It was most strange, there's no one around at all. And I had a drink, gave her a drink. I said, haven't you heard, Jimmy? He says, heard about what? See, the plane has crashed. It never struck me at all. And she said it again. Oh, I said, we'll have another drink. I'm a quick drinker, by the way, and answered my second one quickly. But she said it again, and she started to cry. And then it struck me very vividly. I thought, God, no. The last thing I thought was a plane crash. So in my John Little office there, I went in, I cried myself for 20 minutes, couldn't realise it. It's hard to lose players you've brought up, more or less live with. Very difficult. They start to go into different funerals, you know, it's very, very hard. And probably two will get buried the same day. You know, Johnny buries in the next bed there. Tubes everywhere in his ears, nose fed to the feet. And apparently he was unconscious for weeks with Johnny Berry. How he survived, I wouldn't know. And next to him was the great Edwards. And I sat with him for a while. He was sort of semi-conscious. And he turned his head and he says, "You, Jimmy." And he said, "What time's the kick-off tomorrow?" Fellow.
Yeah, there you are. So, Wayne Barton, who was Jimmy Murphy? Give us the basics, first of all.
Well, he was just about everybody behind the scenes at Manchester United. He's categorised, as you said earlier, as assistant manager and scout. He was youth team coach, of course, for many years before he became the assistant formally. He was described by Nobby Stiles as the nuts and bolts man at Manchester United, and that really, if you can imagine that, it just sort of summarises everything that Jimmy Murphy was, because he was the blood and guts and the spirit behind the Busby Babes and before and after the crash.
He was Welsh. He had 200 appearances for West Brom as a player, and then he moved on to Manchester United in his post-playing career. So the famous line from Matt Busby after the air disaster is to keep the club afloat, keep the flag flying, Jimmy, keep things going until I get back. How long before Busby got back? What did Jimmy Murphy do in the aftermath of Munich?
Well, that's an incredible story, that, because the story goes that Matt Busby was read the last rites, and he was so ill that he actually wasn't aware of the scale of the disaster. He wasn't aware that other people had died, or at least he hadn't been informed of that. And so his question to Jimmy to keep the flag flying was more or less with the intention of, or the belief of, thinking that everything was as it was, you know, and he was the only one hurt. And then Jimmy took that promise, and he went back, and he did sort of, he made good on that promise to keep the cup, keep the flag flying, as Matt asked him to. And really, once he got back to Manchester, Jimmy realised how difficult that would be, because obviously there were so many people not only passed away, but also, you know, their careers were, some players' careers were completely devastated.
Mm. So, you know, he was the youth coach as well, you mentioned, not least from 46 to 55, and then became assistant manager in 55. And that was, United won three FA Youth Cups in a row, and charged really by the Busby Babes. And I mean, it was awful. You hear him talking there about going to visit Duncan Edwards, who's gravely ill at the time, and he talked there about sitting with him, saying it was the saddest thing I've ever seen or been part of. Duncan turned to me and said, oh, it's you, yeah. Jimmy. I said, yes. And I had to put my head to his mouth. And he said, we heard it in the clip, what time's kickoff tomorrow? And Duncan said, get stuck in. And he slipped out of consciousness while Jimmy held his hand. What effect did Munich have on him?
His son, Jimmy Jr., he puts it very, very succinctly that obviously you heard the clip there of him when he spoke to Alma, the club secretary, where Jimmy was told the news and he went into his office with a bottle of whiskey and he came out 12 hours later, as his son says, a changed man.
Mm.
And so for the few days while Duncan was alive, although he was changed, the grief was really, really rocking him, because obviously it wasn't just the players. Bert Wally was his best friend, the fellow coach we worked closely with, and obviously he wasn't sure if Sir Matt was going to pull through, or Matt as he was at the time. And so he was battling with all these things, but the one thing he was keeping was the hope that Duncan would come back and somehow be a professional footballer again. Even I think he knew in his heart of hearts that wasn't going to be the case. But then when Duncan did pass away and he was told the news in the early hours, it was like he was very defeated after that. He felt defeated for a short period of time. So it really is a human miracle that he found the strength to carry on after that. You say that you ask how he did it. I mean, that's an impossible question to answer, because it's just that's the marvel, isn't it? Really, that's the thing that we're all marveling at, how he did that, how he found the courage and the perseverance to do that. But the one thing that I personally believe is that from that moment on, he really shaped the identity of Manchester United, and, you know, the way that they never give in. And I believe that he did that from that moment.
And what makes you say that, Wayne?
Just because he gave the player, well, he gave Jimmy a greater cause. He gave him a greater thing to pass on to the players. You know, you are fighting for something that's bigger than the badge on the shirt that you're wearing. It's bigger than the shirt that you're wearing. You're playing for the destiny of these people who went before you. And, you know, it became an incredible pressure for those young kids who came in.
Mm.
And we're talking for generations that's gone on. I don't want to sort of plug the book too much, but I spoke to Sir Alex Ferguson for it, and he spoke very openly about using what Jimmy did as a motivational tool for those young players. You know, so it's something that was used as a psychological tool. Obviously, it's a very pressurized kind of thing, because as you can imagine, that can break someone just as easily as it can inspire them. But like I said, I do believe that the inspiration, or the level of inspiration that can come from that, is something that really has defined United's biggest successes. And I do believe that that's traced back to what Jimmy did in carrying on.
I mean, Wayne, obviously in terms of researching the book, you would have dug into the archives. I mean, was his role recognised at the time, or is it only years later that people really truly appreciated what he did?
There's a level of... He wasn't fully underappreciated, because Busby never shied away from the work that Jimmy did, and he would always speak about the work that Jimmy and Bert Wally were doing whenever the plaudits were being heaped on him. Obviously, it became very prominent during those after Munich months, because... It was obvious that, you know, Murphy had done so much work with those young players. And so when he became the first team manager, so to speak, for that short period of time, and people were thinking, well, he was at least half responsible for the Busby Babes, then he started to get a lot more attention. I mean, as early as 1957, so a year before the disaster, he was getting courted before from the likes of Juventus and Brazil.
Why did he turn down Brazil?
Because he just loved Manchester too much. He loved the job that he had so much that he was in paradise, as he put it, and as Sir Matt put it. He just did not want to leave. He would have happily been there as he was for the rest of his life. He absolutely loved it so much. And after the disaster, it became more like a burning ambition for him to make sure that he provided another Youth Cup winning team. So that became his motivation after that, you know, to make good on the potential of those that were lost.
Yeah. He was there until 71 as assistant. So he was there for Wembley in 68 in the European Cup and did scouting work for United through the 70s. So he was there. I mean, he got to have that moment with Busby and Charlton in 68.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for most sports fans or for most observers of football, you look at a European Cup and you see it as a culmination of a great team. For Matt Busby in particular, I wouldn't say so much Jimmy Murphy, but maybe them as a pair, certainly, but it seemed like the culmination of a journey. So whereas you would have the outpouring of celebration and everything like that and the jubilation, there was very much a bittersweet feeling for those, you know, that for Busby and Murphy, that it was the culmination of a journey and sort of like the justification of something that they set out to achieve at the start.
Okay, Wayne, thanks for joining us. The book again, Jimmy Murphy, The Man Who Kept the Red Flag Flying, is released February 15. Thanks so much, Wayne.
Thank you.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.